Hello and welcome to another episode of Start Writing. I'm Jay Washburn and my co-host is...
Govindowski?
And we're doing the eighth episode, I believe, of A Beginner's Guide to Writing a Novel. And we're continuing our discussion on plot today. And I'm calling this subplot. It's not entirely subplot. It's more like complex plots, but some of it will be about subplots. I came across this quote and I had to bring it up. Keats says, "If poetry comes not as naturally as the leaves to a tree, it had better not come at all." And I just think it's hilarious that his metaphor is a gardener, and he's saying as a poet, he believes you should be a gardener. And I think if you are a gardener, if you're Stephen King and that works, then good on you and lean into that skill. I think he's a stellar writer. But what we're talking about is being architects today and have been, because that's what I am and that's what I think that my stories need. And I might just say that, like, if you're a gardener, lean into that. But if you're failing as a gardener and you think you're a gardener, maybe you need some of what we're going to talk about today. And maybe being more of an architect is worthwhile.
Yeah, I know I've said this like 100 times on the show, but like the method to writing, whether you're a gardener or an architect, is really about whatever makes the writing process easiest for you. You know, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think I've mentioned, like, the first novel I ever wrote, I wrote as a gardener, and it was brutal. You know, just sitting down at just a blank page with no idea what I was going to write was a nightmare.
Yeah. And I think the same happened to me. I told you the story about my professor writing The Flat Line. And I needed to understand a little bit better the mechanics. So I wanted to, by way of review, last time we talked about the plot clock, and that's the structure that I use to set up a novel. So here on the screen I have, this is the outline. This is basically all I knew about XDOT as I started writing. And to be honest, I don't even think I have a hook, but what the hook is now is that you kind of see Nate's world and how he's torn between being an imaginative kid and like surviving at school and not getting beat up, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's basically the hook. And then what I wrote in my outline was, okay, the pledge, a quarter of the way into the book, Nate is going to find out that these weird dreams that he's been having are actually real. He's going to find proof that something that he dreamed about does exist in the real world. And so then when I was writing the book, it's just like, I just have to fill in from the hook to the pledge and kind of get to that spot where he can have that revelation and it would make sense to a reader. And then my next plot point, the turn, you know, this is 6 o'clock. I knew that Nate somehow became what I call a nexus, meaning not only could so the story's about ghost robots, right? And these weird interdimensional creatures that he's dreaming about from another world. And so like that first plot point, he realizes that they can reach through into his world. And the second plot point is he figures out the method to reach through into their world. And that's all I knew. Like that was my outline. Nate becomes a nexus. That was what I wrote. And I kind of had to figure out as I was writing. And so that's all gardening leading up to that plot point. And then the final plot point that I knew for 9 o'clock was that his friend becomes a nexus, meaning his friend can then interact with this other world. And that actually becomes problematic. But like, that's really all the outline that I had when I wrote that novel. And I just gardened. So I have this next shot here. This is what I did. After I had that outline, then I'm just writing, I'm trying to write the NaNoWriMo amount per day. And I kept up with it pretty good. And that's how I drafted this book. I'm just punching out these chapters to fill in that outline. And then there was a ton of editing that I had to do afterward. In fact, months, like 6 or 9 months till I kind of felt like the book was done. But I just kind of want to show an example of how the plot clock is this bare bones system. And at least for me, that's what worked for me, is I garden in between and just kind of fill in those gaps as I go. Mm-hmm. So I was going to talk about Song of Locke's plot clock as well, but I'm not sure that it's going to add much.
So I'm not familiar with this clock, but I think I saw your plot clock while you were writing Starchild, and like you had like in your outline, you had every chapter with a little summary written out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a sec, but yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
So, well, and that's the thing, like, Song of Locke is written by a single narrator, and everything is just linear following that single person throughout the whole story. And I think that the plot clock works really well for setting that up with like just having one character. And the same is almost true of X-Dot. X-Dot does have these other chapters that go into the Ghost Robot's view, but they don't push the plot forward a ton. They're almost more supplemental. But I wanted to write something more complex when I did Starchild, and I wanted to have many character viewpoints, and that simple outline wasn't working as well. And so I'll show you here in a sec kind of how I innovated on that. Real fast, I just wanted to say though, so Song of Locke, it's written in those four parts, you know, you could call it four acts that go around the clock. And my intention was to have about 25% for each of those sections, right? And in the book, like you can literally see my four acts because it's just called scroll one, scroll two, scroll three, scroll four. But when you actually look at it after the fact, you'll notice that scroll one is about 30% of the book. It's like a third of the book. And I've had readers tell me, well, I thought the beginning was a little slow. And I think like that's very apparent that I took 30% of the time to get to that first plot point. And I probably should have done it in 25 or less. Like, I think the quicker you get there, the more they're going to feel like, oh, I know what this story's about. I know where it's going. And I'm now rooting for the hero to accomplish that.
I remember reading Song of Locke, and there was just a lot of character building in the early chapters that other things weren't going on or very little was. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, like, I am a character writer, and I want to be careful that I'm not killing my characters by shortening that beginning. But I think the lesson here is that I was wrong. I went too long in the character building, and you can notice it from this plot clock, and you can tell, oh, section one is too long. It's a third of the book, and it should be a fourth or less. And to be honest, everybody loves the end of my books, and I don't know if that's because the third and fourth acts are compressed, and so it just feels fast and everything's falling in and the dominoes are all there. But that's something I learned from this structure, and I think it's very clearly observable, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Okay, another quote I wanted to share. Richard Peck, he writes young adult, I think mostly fiction, but maybe nonfiction. He says the first chapter is really the last chapter in disguise. And this is where I wanted to talk about plots and subplots. And so what I've got up on the screen here is this, it looks like a rainbow, right? And across the top, the red arc, I have it labeled as main plot. And what I mean by that is like, this is killing Voldemort, right? This is like the main problem that is going to be an arc from page one, and it's going to get resolved right at the very end. And I've read books from budding author friends of mine who you don't get to that red line until you're a little ways into the story. And that looks like this one up on the screen. And so that your rainbow isn't a rainbow because that arc doesn't start until like a third of the way into the story. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
And I've told you in my plot clock that you make the pledge at 25%, but in your hook, you need to be hinting. Like, yeah, you don't have to explain the whole pledge yet, but you need to be starting it off right at the beginning. This is a romance novel. I can tell from the very first page that this is going to be about falling in love, or this is going to be about dinosaurs. You know, you need to let them know right off and not wait on it. Anyway, and then I kind of put the subplots underneath. So like you have this next arc underneath the red arc, and you know, it's like, oh my gosh, can I impress this girl? So this is Harry and Ginny and Cho, you know, it's like the romance arc, and you want to introduce the next most important arc second, and you need to resolve that one second to last, and so on. And I have a green arc and a blue and purple. But
I like this.
Yeah.
Did you see this somewhere else, or was this something you made up, the rainbow?
This is just like kind of how I think about it. I'm not sure I've seen it somewhere else.
I really like this. I really like this. I think this is great.
Yeah.
I hope you guys look up his video so that you can see kind of the rainbow, the way he's laid it out. It's, yeah.
So yeah, and by the way, if you're listening to the podcast, I have a link to the YouTube video in the show notes. So just click that there, and that'll get you on over. So, okay, so this next slide, this is because of you, Joe. Joe talked about hot spots, and so you can have your rainbow skewed in a way. So I made it so like your blue and your violet arc are at the very center bottom of the rainbow, and they're introduced late in the story and they're resolved early in the story. And I think that's a completely great way to go if you want. You can introduce these miniature little plot lines or plot arcs, and you resolve them not long after opening them. But another way to do this, and this is, Joe, what you've talked about and kind of taught me, is you line up all your arcs so they open up one at a time, but they all resolve together at the very end. And so defeating the bad guy and winning over the girl are somehow tied up in the same moment. Like maybe it's your basketball championship or whatever.
You see this a lot in movies. This is a very common way, is that the hero, in order to defeat the bad guy, must overcome his internal conflict or struggle to be able to rise to that challenge. So a lot of times you'll see the all is lost moment, and at the end of the all is lost moment, the hero reaches that pivotal internal realization, which in turn gives him the strength to conquer the bad guy. And so you get those two plot points kind of resolving right together to create that hot spot.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention, because the other rainbow that I showed contradicts this slightly, and I think both of them are very viable. Like it's okay to open up some plot arc late and close it early, but it's also, it can be really powerful if it closes at the same moment as the main plot, if you can pull that off. Yeah. Okay, so in contrast to Keats, J.K. Rowling is a planner, and I'll just read this quote. She says, I really plan quite meticulously. I know it is sometimes quite boring. When people say to me, I write stories at school, and what advice would you give me to make my stories better? I always say, and people's faces often fall, you have to plan. And they say, oh, I prefer just writing and seeing where it takes me. And her response to that is, sometimes writing and seeing where it takes you will lead you to some really good ideas. But I would say nearly always, it won't be as good as if you sat down first and thought, where do I want to go? And what end am I working towards? And what would be a good start? And
so, well, and I think this is really interesting. And she's definitely an architect, but I mean, George R. R. Martin is famous for his brilliant plots, and he's a gardener.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's a gardener in a very different way than a lot of people are. Like a lot of gardeners, you just kind of write and see where it goes, and you edit and fix things. I think Martin throws out massive piles of manuscript
mm-hmm.
because he gardens, and then he sees where it goes, and he's like, that's interesting. And then he goes back, and he starts over, and he just you'd almost say he gardens all the rows and then picks the best pieces from each row. And that's how he gets an incredible plot while still being a gardener and not a planner.
Yeah. Well, and two things I think about. One is, we've literally waited a decade, I think, for his next book to come out. And I think that's a gardener problem. The other thing is, J.K. Rowling specifically writes mystery novels. And Like after she graduated from Harry Potter, that's the genre she was writing was mystery novels. But the fact is, even Harry Potter is kind of constructed like a mystery novel. And in order to put the clues in and stuff leading up to that big reveal, kind of Agatha Christie style, you sort of need to know where it's going. And so I think she's writing a different type of story than George Martin. And I mean, not that his don't have these great surprises. They have massive surprises. And those surprises probably surprised him too, as he was writing. But yeah, it may depend on the type of book that you're trying to write as well.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, I do know mystery writers who are gardeners. What is it? I think it was Neil Gaiman who was saying, the first draft is just getting it down. The second draft is making it look like you did it on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
You know? And so I think that's kind of the gardener, you know, if you're a gardener and you're writing a mystery, I think that's what happens, right? Like you realize you need this, 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 and you write it all down. Yeah. In the first draft, it doesn't even make sense. Be like, wait, this clue's not even here. Be like, not yet. That comes in second draft. You know, I put that in there.
Yeah.
So I think even as a mystery writer, you can be a gardener. And like you said, you take the Gaiman advice and the second draft is plugging in all the holes. So it looks like you did it on purpose and it was always planned out.
Yeah. I think that's a fair point. And yeah. Okay. So, and to be honest, I don't know what advice you would give to a gardener other than just write, like go back and write. Have you written today? Go write. Like that seems like the whole lecture on how to be a gardener, but maybe I'm wrong because I'm not a gardener and I don't totally know how it works. Although, like I said, I am a gardener sometimes, and I do feel like just hitting that page, like just get something out. And a lot of times it's something really cool. Okay, so now up on the screen, I have Rowling published an outline that she did for The Order of the Phoenix. And in the left column, she writes the chapter number. And then the next column is the time. And that's the time in the story. And I can't remember if I've told this story in this series, but when I was writing X-Dot, it was like, okay, so this happened at school. And then he went home and like this was a debriefing, or like here's what happened after school. And then the next day, this is what happened. And as I was drafting, I got into that and I'm like, I think I've probably written more than 5 consecutive school days. And I wasn't sure, but I was like, well, I never put a weekend in there. So I went back and I looked and I had, I think, 12 consecutive school days. And so I had to rearrange my story so that 2 of those school days were weekend days. I think it's really cool. That
is so interesting.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, I had no clue. I'm just sitting there gardening. And it's like, well, this happened at school. And I'm not thinking about whether it's a Tuesday or a Friday. It's just like, this happened at school. I'm just writing a story. But anyway, so she writes out this happens in October. These 3 are in November. Then we have 3 in December. And I think that kind of, it's like you're creating a calendar for your story. And I've kind of done that since learning that lesson in X-Dot. And to realize that, man, I'm going to write something that just doesn't make sense unless I have some way to kind of keep it reined in.
Yeah.
And then our next column is the title. Next column is like the main plot. This is what happens in this chapter. And then her next column is about the prophecy. Actually, I'm going to skip to the next slide. So this Carrie, the friendly editor, typed up her handwritten. I'm all about spreadsheets, but J.K. Rowling just writes it on a piece of paper. It's a little hard to read. But so her next column is the prophecy, and she writes it out so that you can see, okay, this concept of the prophecy is progressing a little bit in every single chapter, and I'm moving that idea forward. And then she has a column for Cho and Ginny, right? That's like the romance. And she's making sure, okay, whoa, this romance is developing. And if you just look at the column, you can see, oh, this is a little story all on its own. Like we have a romance novel right here. That column is a romance novel, but it's attached to these other chapters. And so it's like, it's a subplot now, right? She has a column for Order of the Phoenix, Dumbledore's Army, Snape and Harry, and then Hagrid and Grop.
I love this. I'm going to do this.
Well, and the cool thing is like, maybe say you have a romance or you're wanting to write a romance subplot And then you go and map it out like this and you realize, oh, I have four chapters in a row that didn't do squat about the romance subplot. And you don't have to do a lot, but you need to like keep that thread going in order to like have it be a significant part of your story. And I think the way that she laid it out here is pretty cool and seems really helpful.
Yeah, I'm gonna start doing this. I loved it.
Okay, so this next slide, it just shows in green, it shows what J.K. Rowling added. And like, this isn't something that's in her outline. It's just this reader went and figured out, okay, I'm looking at the actual published book and these green things she added. And then yellow is things she moved. So it's like, well, I thought this was going to be chapter one and now it's chapter five, you know? So she's moving stuff around. And then the red is what she deleted.
I guess I would have to see this bigger and go through it. So, well, I mean, it's nothing you can do. If you can put a link to this, then I can go to the page itself.
Okay. Well, actually, yeah, man, I should put a link to the slides maybe, but
yeah.
But to be honest, the little stuff doesn't matter so much. What matters is this is the gardening aspect of her architecting, right? She wrote an outline, and then once she's boots on the ground, she's like, I need to change this. I can feel it, or I can sense it, or it's just not growing that way. Yeah. So I need to do this. Yeah. And so, and as you can see, like this entire page has been changed. Like there's probably like seven squares out of, you know, however many dozens that didn't get changed, right? Almost everything was affected in some way once she's, you know, boots on the ground or editing or whatever. I think, again, that's an important thing to allow your story to grow as it needs to and as it fits. So that's a way to do a more complex plot and do more and like have subplots that make sense and that your readers can trace throughout the book. I kind of already introduced this, but Song of Locke, single narrator, single perspective, right? And then I'm writing this epic space opera, and I'm partially doing this to grow as a writer. I wanted to do multiple viewpoints, but the fact is my simple plot, my plot clock was not quite cutting it. One thing that I changed when I did the plot clock for this book was it was sort of like, this is what happens to the team, and not necessarily what happens to an individual as they're going through those plot points. But then I came up with this idea, and again, this is how I conceptualize it, and I hope that it's helpful to you, maybe. In a musical staff, you have pitch. That's the Y-axis. And if you move a note up and down, you're changing the pitch. You're changing which note is playing. And then your X-axis is your rhythm, right? And you can create these beautiful works of musical art with just pitch and rhythm, right? It's a very simple thing. So I had to flip that because of how a spreadsheet works and how lines go sideways. But I'm basically creating what I call a plot staff. And we have characters across the top. So the column headers are character names. And those are the different notes that we're going to play throughout the book. And then our rhythm is now the Y-axis, the up and down. And that's when these character perspectives come in. And that's our plot staff. So this slide is... Well, and I should say, I've never created a plot staff before writing. I always made these after drafting the first draft, and it helped me to reorganize and to edit. But I think it is possible to do this detailed of an outline, but I just need to be on record of saying this is my editing outline rather than my drafting outline. And I can't guarantee that it works well for drafting, but I know that it has worked very well for me with editing. And I do is like column one is in purple and the character Cal, like these are each of her chapters. And I write out her chapter one is called The Uncrowned Queen. And then on here, I blurted out for the sake of spoilers, but I actually write a little synopsis. These are the key points that take place in chapter one. And then if you follow her column down, chapter seven is hers. Chapter 12 is hers. Chapter 15 is hers. And you start to see this rhythm where it's like, okay, Cal is popping into this story at a pretty consistent interval. If you look at the next column, Knack, his chapters are maybe even more consistent. And at the top of my spreadsheet, I have it automatically tally how many chapters are for that character. So, and that tells you another thing, which is like, is my story really devoted to the person who I'm thinking of as the main character? And and that takes place here where Knack actually has one chapter more than any other character. And his rhythm is very consistent. Boom, boom, boom. You know, chapter 3, 6, 10, 14. And they're pretty evenly spaced throughout. The next character is Cupcake, and she has a third chapter that's actually down off the screen, but she's very sparse, right? She introduces part of the book, she's in the middle, and then she's again at the end. And I'm okay with that. I think that could be a red flag with some characters where you see that and you're like, oh, this character is not showing up, and that seems like a problem. In this case, she interacts with other characters, so it's almost like she gets extra chapters, like, for example, when she's talking or interacting with Knack or Cal. So that like kind of makes that okay. However, in the next column, you'll see the green. We have the knight, that's Benton, chapter 4, and then we don't see him again until chapter 17, right? There's this huge gap for Benton, and we just don't get his perspective for like the whole first half of the book after his one chapter. And that's kind of a problem. And you'll actually notice that he comes in more rapidly at the end, maybe overwhelming in rhythm. And it's funny, my daughter, I read this story to her, well, I kind of read it / told it to her, and she loves the character Benton. But the fact is, almost all readers don't really love the character Benton. And she's so frustrated. She's like, well, he's so cool, and I like him because this, and I just think he's a great like romantic partner, and da-da-da. And she's frustrated that readers don't like him more. And I think it has something to do with the way his character is, but I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that we introduce him in chapter 4 and we don't see him again until like halfway through the book. And again, that's something that this type of outline can highlight for you. So I'm going to skip a couple rows over to Tybros. Tybros is the bad guy, and you'll see here he kind of like a fourth of the way into the book, he gets three chapters in a row and then done. Or sorry, not in a row, but pretty consistently and then done. And in a later draft, I changed that. So this is my earlier outline.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, Tybros needs like, there should be a beat. Like I can see that his rhythm deserves to sound right there. And so I added a chapter in that kind of brings us back to his perspective. And it kind of keeps that rhythm going because he's a character that I don't feel like it's okay to just have that gap for. And I didn't see it when I was reading my book. I saw it when I looked at this outline and saw, oh, I need the rhythm to repeat right there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not only that, but I mean, like, looking at this, what I see is you introduce him at chapter 8. We see him again at 16, which would be the midpoint turn. And then we see him again at 20. Which you know could be the second pinch point, mm-hmm. and then after that he would be in the book a lot, but not from his perspective because it'd be the hero interacting with him. But mm-hmm. what's missing from him is his first pinch point.
Mm. Well,
right? And
so,
I can see that just looking at this. And like you said, you went back and changed things. But,
yeah. It's you're exactly right. And honestly, a lot of the pinch point, well, like that threat is. He shows that he's threatening, and then the other characters experience the threat. But yeah, you're exactly right that we need to feel that bad guy and that presence. And seeing from his perspective, honestly, that was a huge problem I had when I wrote Song of Locke. I wanted to show the bad guy's perspective, but I never had an opportunity because it was only what the hero saw, because he narrates the book, right?
Right.
Anyway, so I wanted to take advantage of that here and say, you know, I can get in the bad guy's head, so I'm going to, and I'm going to make it count. And then, like, if anybody's a secondary character, it's Link. He's this last column here, and I have him, you know, midway into the first half and midway into the second half. And when I laid this out, I was totally fine with where his rhythm hits and that he only has 2 points. But what I did realize that was that if you just took these chapters, just these two out of the whole book and read them together as a short story, is that a story? And in my first draft, it wasn't. It was just like, well, he does this and then he does that. And they didn't fit together. And so I added his arc so that he's struggling with one thing. He changes his perspective at the end of his first chapter. And then having that new perspective, that midpoint for him, that then plays out. And like he lives with the consequences of that in his second chapter. So it's like a little mini story. And again, I can see that because of how I laid it out here.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And then I wanted to talk about, this is actually a nonfiction example, but I've been working a ton on this and I think that it's relevant to the plot staff that I just showed you. So I got this idea and it's like, I want to write about how, we've talked about this on these episodes, but how Charlton Heston in Secret of the Incas looks exactly like Indiana Jones, but he was 30 years before Indiana Jones. So Indiana Jones right. clearly copied Charlton Heston, right? And I wanted to write about, I'm going to dive into this and figure out why this happened or how it happened or how often it happened. And so I jump in, I start drafting, and I write about, you know, here's what it's like to plagiarize, and here's the line between plagiarism and inspiration, okay, right?
Right.
But as I'm going, I start realizing, well, I have a lot to say about my boyhood and how, like, I was a huge fan of Indiana Jones. So I'm like telling these anecdotes about my boyhood life and those kind of start popping in to the manuscript. Uh-huh. And then as I get toward the end of the manuscript, I start writing about how my older brother died. Cause like he died a couple years ago and it was very impactful. It was like this heavy topic, but his death is very closely linked to my love of Indiana Jones. And so like, I'm slowly kind of figuring out what this essay is about. But so on this next slide on the left, I have, again, three like plot staff columns and the red on the left, that's what I'm writing about, plagiarism and inspiration. Then the middle one is like boyhood. And the third one, blue, is like, this is about my older brother passing away. And it was the same type of thing where I realized, well, if this is really about death, and about what it's like to lose a loved one, I can't introduce that topic at the very end. And so right. what I did is you see in column two here, I made chapters about my brother dying throughout so that not only could the reader feel that loss in the beginning, but it could progress and develop over the course of the manuscript. And I just organized it as ABC, 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 like it just goes from each of those topics in an order. But then once I laid it out like this and I made my plot staff, I realized that I had two B's, like the indie fan stuff in the last segment. So it felt like a stutter. I keep going ABC, ABC, but then at the end it's ABBC. And I didn't want to have like a super long chapter, but I needed to figure out a way to put that. I figured that it could go into part two and that's what column three is here. But I found out that I could fit three B columns or rows in section two if I reverse the order. So it goes ABC and then in that middle section, it goes BA, CBA, CBA. And that allowed me to fit that in. But this is just another example, kind of a weird example of how the plot staff can work and how it can like give you this overview so that you can kind of refine how your story and your plot fit together.
Yeah. I remember one person talking about you know, going to critique groups and getting critiques from other writers and he compared it to like you're in the kitchen, right? And your critique group will pick up a plate and be like, "Well, this one's dinged or scratched or maybe it's a little dirty here. The dishwasher wasn't strong enough to scrub this off, whatever." And you know, they're really looking at this one thing, and the writer's job is to see the whole kitchen, everything that is going on with all the pieces. But a lot of times, I think you're right. It's hard for us to see the whole picture sometimes. Mm-hmm. And these tools that you've shown us, the rainbow, and you know, this map you saw from rolling and everything, and your marked up one here about your essay is really about creating tools for us so we can see the whole picture, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes we think we imagine in our mind what we have written, and that might not match up with what we've actually written. And these tools are just to help us see it better. Like, what is it? I know, like with basketball players, one of the things they'll do with early, you know, kids in college is usually it's, unless you went to like a really fancy high school, it's the first time they film you doing different things. And then they can show you, be like, your coach has been telling you this forever. And now for the first time, you can see it.
Yeah.
You can see your arm sticking out weird or see how you do something funny. And it's like, oh, wow, I'm definitely doing that wrong. You know, and to get that insight is really useful for athletes to see themselves performing something, knowing how it's supposed to be done, and then having the real image compared with how they're imagining it play out in their head and seeing that incongruence and being able to fix it. And I think that's what these tools are about.
Yeah.
Letting you see the book how it is and not just how you're imagining it.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to like part with three little tips about that I think can maybe help, and then we'll wrap up this episode. So the first is, I love this story. As a young adult, I read the Lloyd Alexander Chronicles of Prydain, and I recently found out that his editor read the fifth book once he finished it. And by the way, that's a Newbery winning book. Like it's a good book. But when his editor read book five, she said, there's something missing, and it's an entire book that comes before it. And basically she was saying, your hero is mature and heroic, and there's a gap from where he was as a young boy to where he is as a man in this final book. And she said, you need to write a book four that comes before this that gets him there and that develops him there. And
yeah.
I just think a lot of times you can't see that, and you need a good editor to point that kind of stuff out to you. And honestly, it also helps this is an advantage of an indie author, but you can publish all your books as eBooks and then go back and make edits and changes as you need to. It's almost like publishing a draft in a way where you could easily insert a fourth book and it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But sometimes that is a big deal if you're working with a big publisher. But okay, the next tip is just that. So here on the screen, I have an outline of, so I wrote X dot, it's gonna have three sequels. So it's four books total. Then Song of Locke is a trilogy. Star Child is three trilogies. And the reason I'm putting this up here is to demonstrate that all of my ideas are huge. And I think if you're a writer, if you're an author at heart, your ideas are probably all huge too. And you probably have more ideas than you know what to do with, right? But my tip here is to think about the scope of what you're doing and pare it down. Try to find the smallest chunk at the beginning of your story that you can turn into a fulfilling arc where, you know, my person is going on a quest and they're finishing their quest and that feels good and it feels done and it feels like a complete story. And don't let all your big ideas be too much of a burden to you. Like chop it down to something manageable and write the smallest story that you can find that happens at the beginning. And then once you've nailed that and published and completed that first complete story, then go on to the rest of your big ideas. Because I guess for me, I just sometimes almost feel overwhelmed with how many ideas I have and how much I wish I could write, but I can't. And I think just chopping it down and publishing something and making that really good is an important first step. So, I mean, this is a beginner's guide. That's my tip for beginners. Oh, sorry. Do you have a comment about that?
No. You mentioned a beginner guide. I was like, oh yeah, this is a beginner's guide. I feel like this version of the beginner's guide is like after you have draft one.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I even want to talk about editing here in the next couple of lectures, but yeah. to be honest, this turned from the beginner's guide into like, this is everything I can teach you about how I've written my novels. So I guess I got a little beyond the scope, but I hope it's somewhat concise. Maybe, you know, 9 episodes is not too much, but okay. So the last one, I'm a big fan of the Legend of Zelda series, and Ocarina of Time is about this boy Link and his fairy companion that go out on this big adventure. And what's at stake is the entire kingdom of Hyrule, right? It's really big and it's epic in what it is attempting to do, right? This is a save the world plot. And then Ocarina of Time has a direct sequel where it begins with Child Link and he's sitting on the back of his horse. He's going through this haunted looking forest that's gloomy. And his shoulders are slumped, his head is bowed, and he's going so slow, it's at a pace that he seems not only depressed, but it seems like he literally no longer has an objective. And it's just like this depressing and sad and gloomy, but in kind of a romance sort of way. But then the narration comes up and it says, "Done with the battles he once waged across time, the hero embarked on a journey. A secret and personal journey, a journey in search of a beloved and invaluable friend." And when you see that line, all of a sudden you're like, whoa, wait a sec. Where's the fairy? His fairy's not with him. And so he had this best friend companion that was with him for the entire game to save the world. And this next game starts out with saying he's looking for his friend. And I just got to say, like, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic, right? Saving Hyrule is a million deaths, right? But saving your friend is a tragedy. And to be honest, this pledge right here that Majora's Mask gives is a way better pledge than what we get in the first game. And this goes with my last tip, which is cut it down to the scope that is like the smallest chunk that makes a good story. And same with this tip. It's like, don't go epic. Don't save the whole world. You don't need to. It's going to be stronger if you save your best friend. Yeah. So there we go. That's my last tip. That's the end of what we're going to talk about, plot. I want to talk about titles and editing, and then we're going to wrap up the beginner's guide. Hopefully that's one or two more episodes.
All right. Sounds good. So look up the links. I took screenshots of Jay's slides today because they are so good. Like, because a lot of the things he talked about was turning the text of a novel and the chapters into something visual so you can see it, so you can see the whole picture. And so I really recommend going and looking at the images from this episode because they've helped me a lot. Like I loved it. And so, like I said, I took some screenshots because I was like, I definitely want to look at my plot in this lens to help me understand it better.
Yeah, man. So I remembered what I was going to say earlier. You can't always see, like when you read a draft over and over, you don't have the experience that a reader has. You have the experience of someone who's sick of this manuscript, right? That's a different experience. But I find I can get that view refreshed if I just wait 3 months or 6 months. But the fact is, when I'm writing, I don't feel like I have time to wait and like let my head clear and get that fresh perspective all the time. You know, sometimes I can wait a shorter amount of time. But I think it helps a lot to do these kind of outlines or to have good beta readers who can give you that experience and say, hey, you're missing this here. You need to write the fourth Taran book and insert it here. Because a lot of times you just can't see it unless you're willing to give it that time. And honestly, I just feel like time is of the essence. That's like the one thing we can't always give to these stories, even though maybe they deserve them. But okay, well, thank you for listening. It's time to start writing.
This is great. This is my favorite episode.
Oh, excellent. Man, that is great to hear.